Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds by Charles Mackay, 3rd edition. History is replete with moments when reason succumbs to the intoxicating force of collective belief. Entire societies, gripped by illusion, have abandoned prudence in favor of mass delusion only, to awaken amid the wreckage of their own folly. A single tulip commands the price of a grand estate. Paper fortunes vanish in an instant. A whispered accusation ignites a pyre. Wars are waged not out of necessity or strategy, but in pursuit of salvation or gold-spun fantasies. Financial bubbles, the Crusades, tulip mania, alchemy, and witch hunts are not merely historical curiosities. They are recurring manifestations of a deeper human tendency. We flatter ourselves as rational beings, guided by reason and discernment. Yet Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds by Charles Mackay dismantle this comforting illusion. Through incisive historical analysis, Mackay chronicles how entire populations have, time and again, mistaken folly for wisdom, speculation for wealth, and superstition for truth. The most disconcerting revelation? This pattern is far from extinct. This book serves as both a historical autopsy and a cautionary tale, holding a mirror to the cycles of hysteria, blind optimism, and mass irrationality that continue to shape societies. The delusions that fueled the past are not relics, they have simply evolved. And as you reach the final page, one unsettling question remains. Are we any less susceptible today? The Mississippi Scheme. Imagine a lively Paris in 1717, where a silver-tongued Scotsman named John Law strides into the city with a bold notion that's poised to ignite France. Law, armed with his keen intellect and even keener charisma, persuades a financially strained government still recovering from Louis XIV's extravagant excesses to hand him the reins of his Mississippi Company. He's touting streams of treasure from Louisiana, a soggy frontier beyond the Atlantic, and people can't resist the allure. Shares begin selling like wildfire, prices soaring as everyone from nobles to pastry chefs dives in, envisioning instant wealth. Law weaves stories of boundless prosperity, churning out paper currency as if it's limitless, and before long, Paris is humming with fresh millionaires, a term coined amid the frenzy. It's a dazzling display, a whirlwind of ambition and avarice, where every coin invested seems like a path to utopia. Yet, as early 1720 dawns, the luster begins to fade. Rumors slink through the alleys. Where's all this wealth law swore by? People start scrutinizing their piles of paper money, questioning whether it holds any value. Abruptly, the tide turns. Investors race to cash out, prices plummet, and chaos spreads like a storm. Law, once celebrated as a genius, flees France in disgrace, abandoning a trail of broken dreams and a nation staggering. It's a heart-wrenching tale. Greed transformed a brilliant vision into a disaster, and the aftermath wounds France's faith in grand ventures for decades. You can almost feel the shared dismay as the bubble bursts, a gripping ascent and devastating plunge that makes you ponder how anyone bought into it and how near we still teeter to that brink today. The South Sea Bubble. Enter London, 1720, where the South Sea Company's whipping up a mania that's got the entire city enthralled. These folks secure a contract to trade with South America's Spanish colonies, flaunting images of galleons brimming with riches. The snag? Spain's hardly rolling out the welcome mat, yet nobody minds optimism's a potent elixir. By spring, they charm Parliament into allowing them to absorb Britain's war debt, pumping out shares that rocket from $100 to over $1,000 in a flash. Exchange Alley morphs into a carnival. Aristocrats, merchants, and even servants are tossing cash in as dubious bubble companies sprout, peddling absurdities like perpetual motion gadgets. It's thrilling, addictive, a frenzied sprint where every wager seems a guaranteed win, and the atmosphere buzzes with fantasies of hitting the jackpot. Soon, though, the collapse hits, fast and fierce, like a gale toppling a fragile tower. Insiders bail out. Whispers spread that the company's trade is a hollow promise, and by fall, the floor caves in. Shares plummet, wealth evaporates, and the streets resound with shouts of outrage. Parliament investigates, uncovering a web of corruption and secret pacts, revealing the elites were complicit in the ruse. The South Sea bubble pops with a harsh, messy bang, leaving Britain dazed and jaded, a warning carved into the annals of time. It's a roller coaster from beginning to end, a breathtaking rise and a jarring fall that captivates with its sheer nerve evidence that when the masses charge unchecked, the crash is never gentle. The Tulipomania. journey back to Holland in the 1630s, where the Dutch are thriving atop their trade empire and tumbling headlong into a love affair with tulips. Indeed, those lovely blossoms from Turkey ignite a frenzy that's far from typical. Scarce bulbs, particularly those sporting quirky, virus-streaked hues, begin commanding outrageous sums. Imagine a lone bulb trading for a home or a year's wages. By 1636, it's utter chaos. Merchants abandon their regular work, crowding into dim taverns to wager on bulbs still tucked underground, swapping futures as if they're in the strangest card game ever. It's a delirious, flower-driven bash where a petal outshines gold, and all are certain the boom will last forever. Suddenly, February 1637 arrives, and the party halts abruptly. Buyers disappear, sellers are left clutching bulbs nobody desires, and prices plummet quicker than you can whisper, tulip. Wealth dissolves, courts jam with disputes over failed trades, and Holland's left puzzling over the wreckage. The fallout isn't cataclysmic, the nation's too resilient for that. Yet, the embarrassment endures, lampooned in art and verse as a botanical blunder. It's an eccentric, enthralling story of how a humble flower morphed into a nationwide fixation, then a jest. You can't resist being drawn in, swept up by the sheer strangeness of it all, pondering what we'd pursue today if the perfect trigger struck. The Alchemists. Imagine a dim workshop century past, where a frantic-eyed alchemist labors over simmering cauldrons, pursuing a vision as ancient as the earth, transforming lead into gold. These figures, consider Paracelsus, Roger Bacon, or Bernard of Trevis, aren't merely experimenting. They're embarked on a hunt for the philosopher's stone, a fabled jewel offering riches and everlasting life. Monarchs and aristocrats shower them with wealth, captivated by the lure of endless treasure or a shortcut to eternity. It's a mesmerizing blend of science and mysticism, John Dee's enchanting Queen Elizabeth with celestial prophecies, while others weave deceit to swindle naive nobles. Each haze-filled lab becomes a theater for this tense spectacle, where defeat isn't tolerated and the atmosphere hums with potential. Yet the end comes swiftly as time marches forward. Most alchemists wind up destitute or worse, Bernard's left empty-handed after duping German royalty. Others meet the noose when their brews flop. The rise of true science sweeps their enchantments away, relegating their story to a poignant aside. A handful of useful metallurgy techniques, perhaps, but largely a path of shattered hopes. It's a riveting tale of genius and missteps, where the craving for the unattainable pushes men to collapse. You're drawn in by their fervor, hoping for a triumph, only to flinch as truth storms in a perennial lesson that pursuing wonders can either illuminate the world or reduce it to ashes. Modern prophecies. Enter the turmoil of 17th and 18th century Europe, where seers are emerging like sparks, proclaiming ruin or triumph to a tense world. Nostradamus launched the trend in the 1550s with his eerie, cryptic quatrains, and people can't resist bending them to match every disaster or conflict that ensues. Leap ahead to London's Great Plague and Fire in the 1660s. Abruptly, it's a prophet hub, with figures like John Mason and Joanna Southcott insisting divine voices speak to them. Throngs gather, pulses racing with fear or anticipation, poised to revolt or kneel at a signal. It's a gripping tableau pulsing with anguish and devotion, where each forecast ignites a volatile fuse. Soon, though, the illusion shatters repeatedly. Southcott's disciples await a holy child in 1814, only to discover her tomb bare of wonders. Earlier mystics face ridicule or chains when the heavens hold firm. The Enlightenment sweeps through, cooling the fervor, yet not before these oracles etch their legacy. Consider uprisings, treks, even killings, all triggered by their pronouncements. It's a whirlwind of faith and disillusionment, a narrative that seizes you with its stark human draw, souls yearning for clarity in a chaotic realm. You're carried along, torn between marvel and sorrow, captivated by how near these divinations sway to the economic manias elsewhere in Mackay's book twin facets of the same bold, yearning spirit. Fortune-telling. Imagine a dim tavern centuries ago, where a cloaked stranger shuffles tarot cards and murmurs your future for a silver piece. That's fortune-telling in essence, a perennial fixation that's gripped people since Rome's augurs peered into entrails and medieval astrologers charted the skies for monarchs. By the 1500s, it's an outright craze. Nostradamus pens enigmatic verses that haunt Europe for ages, while Mother Shipton, a weathered Yorkshire seer, sends locals quaking with her uncanny chants. Gypsies wander with palmistry, tricksters exploit the naive, and even royals like Catherine de' Medici rely on visionaries to sidestep a blade or two. It's an enticing dance, half longing, half swindle, where each prophecy's a toss of the coin, and the atmosphere hums with the rush of what lies ahead. Here's where it turns riveting. Those predictions didn't just linger, they unleashed tempests. Kings altered campaigns based on celestial counsel. Henry VIII's all-in-while apocalyptic prophecies drove farmers to storm the streets. The frauds flourished, weaving yarn so smooth you'd bet they glimpsed the morrow until the Enlightenment swept through and began probing with tough scrutiny. The crystal balls faded, yet the allure endured. Folk still steal a glance at horoscopes now. It's a whirlwind of a story, brimming with visionaries and rogues, where the future's a wager that might exalt you or break you. You're left chuckling at the nerve, captivated by how a hushed fate could turn the world topsy-turvy. The Magnetizers. Enter 1770s Paris, where Franz Mesmer was parading about in a silk robe, gesturing as if he were leading an unseen symphony. This fellow's got a notion. There's a hidden animal magnetism coursing through us, and he's the master who can adjust it to mend your pains or soothe your jitters. His gatherings are a spectacle. People jerk, faint, or dissolve into sobs as he magnetizes them with metal wands and a gaze that could pierce iron. The elite is enthralled, clients proclaim him wonder, and the excitement's sky high. Abruptly, healing's not just medicine, it's a magical performance. It's sheer drama, charged and bizarre, and you can't peel your eyes from the enchantment he's weaving. Soon, though, the doubters storm in, and it's a splendid chaos. By the 1780s, giants like Benjamin Franklin unravel Mesmer's routine and label it a mental ruse placebo dressed up in style. He's chased off, and his mystique wanes, yet the ripples persist. Hypnotism tips its hat to him. Mackay frames it as a brilliant sham with a sliver of insight. Faith alone could shift peaks, even if the fluid was nonsense. It's a tale that seizes you by the throat, half chuckling at the showmanship, half marveling at the conviction it ignited. You're carried through the ascent and collapse, cheering for the eccentric who braved the abyss only to stumble on truth's sharp brink. Influence of politics and religion on the hair and beard. Ever ponder how a trim could toss you into a cell? Step into the strange realm where hair and beards morph into flags of conviction and defiance. Long ago, in medieval days, monks sport flowing tresses to flaunt their sacred aura. Yet by the 1600s, England's civil war turns it upside down. Roundheads shear it close for Puritan resolve, while cavaliers let it cascade for royal loyalty. Popes mandate facial hair rules, Russia's Peter the Great levies a beard fee to drag his aristocracy forward, and in France, Louis XIII's wig mania crowns you a style icon or an outcast. It's a whirlwind of a story, blades slicing through creed and clout, where each lock spins a tale you never anticipated. The risks spiral wild, imagine executions over a mustache clip. Puritans set wigs ablaze as devil's strands, while a sloppy shave might tag you a turncoat in some monarch's hall. Mackay dives into the lunacy. Hair's not mere fluff, it's a cry, a vow, a raised banner. By the 1700s, the chaos softens, fashion triumphs over preaching, yet the traces linger. This section's an unexpected gem, odd and bold, drawing you into a clash where a razor's edge could rewrite fate. You're snickering at the silliness one moment, stunned the next, captivated by how something so trivial could swell into a roaring tempest. The Crusades. Brace yourself for a chronicle that's as majestic as it is savage, the Crusades, where Europe's knights storm the Holy Land with crosses aloft and blades flashing. It all ignites in 1095, when Pope Urban II sparks a blaze beneath a restless realm, pledging to wrest Jerusalem from Muslim grasp. The zealous throng, knights craving fame, peasants seeking salvation, even children yearning for wonders. By 1099, they've carved a gory toehold, and across 2 centuries, surges of crusaders press on, picture Richard the Lionheart sparring with Saladin in a showdown that's sheer myth. It's a pulse-pounding surge, a quest morphed into battle, where each arid stretch promises a glimpse of forever. Yet the luster fades, and the flaws cut deep. The Children's Crusade in 1212 hits like a blow thousands of youth stride forth, only to wind up enslaved or perished, a storybook turned bleak. Later missions mired in avarice and squabbles, and by 1291, the vision's rubble crusader territory's gone, corpses stacked high. The cost's staggering, hamlets ravaged, coffers drained, and resentment festering for centuries. Still, it's not all ruined commerce flares. Cultures collide, and Europe stirs awake. This saga's a colossus noble, harsh, and enthralling, leaving you agape at the zeal that fueled it and the debris in its wake. You're immersed, sensing the burden of every stride, riveted until the final standard drops. The Witch Mania. Imagine a quiet hamlet in 1600s Europe, where a gnarled digit or an odd glance could tag you a witch and send you up in flames. That's the Witch Mania, a dread-driven spiral that transforms neighbors into terrors. It flares up with the Malleus Maleficarum in 1486, a witch slayer's guide, and before long, the continent's ablaze 40,000 to 60,000 lives, mostly female, racked and roasted. Rulers like James VI of Scotland plunge in, clerics rant about satanic deals, and crowds roar as the pyres ignite. It's a creeping nightmare, heavy with fear and despair, where terror tangles reason into chaos, and each murmur spells doom. The height is utter bedlam. Germany's Bamberg trials erase hundreds. Salem's 1692 hysteria seizes the new world, and the cries resound wide. Then, as if a tempest lifts, sanity edges in during the 1700s, scholars puncture myths, judges relent, and the blazes fade. The wounds linger, though, existences torn, faith broken, all over a ghost of a menace. McKay casts it as lunacy unleashed, where fright morphed shades into demons. This one's a spine-tingler that grabs you heart-eerie, sorrowful, and all too vivid, leaving you dazed at how panic can spark a blaze, and grateful when the haze finally parts. The Slow Poisoners. Imagine yourself at an elegant Renaissance dinner, savoring wine alongside a duke, when a cunning smirk across the table suggests your next breath could be your last. That's the Slow Poisoners' realm, a chilling band of assassins who turn death into a subtle, sophisticated craft. In 16th-century Italy, figures like the Borgias elevated poisoning to a fine art. Lucretias, said to have discreetly dosed goblets with arsenic, eliminating family foes with a sly glance. Meanwhile, Giulia Tofana, a Sicilian woman, hawked Acqua Tofana, a colorless, odorless killer that dispatched hundreds before anyone suspected a thing. It's a murky tangle of deception and pursuit. Nobles scrutinize every platter, suspicion becomes the centerpiece, and the allure of a silent, undetectable demise keeps the poisoners thriving. You're drawn into this macabre waltz, pondering who'll be the next to taste the fatal vintage. The frenzy spreads beyond borders by the 1670s. France is embroiled in the Affair of the Poisons, where even Louis XIV's lover, Madame de Montespan, gets entangled in a web of lethal schemes and sinister rites. The scandal erupts. Trials ensnare dozens, executions follow, and soon every apothecary's under scrutiny. The catch is, it's part hysteria, part evidence gossip outpaces the truth. Mackay serves it up as a brew of greed and dread, where a single drop of poison could unravel a dynasty or even a grudge. It's a simmering saga, grim, gripping, and utterly haunting, keeping you captivated by the ingenuity behind every deadly draft and trembling at how precariously power balanced on a toxic brink. Haunted houses. Ever pick up an odd feeling in an old house and feel certain something's staring? That's the haunted house mania, a hair-raising fixation that had people flinching at shadows long ago. By the 1700s, England's drafty estates are phantom hotspots. Picture Berkeley Square in London, where a jinxed room allegedly pushed tenants to madness, or Cock Lane's Scratching Fanny, a ghost so noisy in 1762 that mobs swarmed the street to catch her raps. Every creak or glimmer spins a story: lost monks, scorned brides, chains scraping through the night, and folks lap it up, part scared, part enchanted. It's a thrill fest of shivers, and you're right in it, squinting into the shadows, captivated by what might be waiting beyond the bend. The chaos ramps up when the faithful dive headfirst. Uproars ignite over a spectral thud. Clergy brandish blessings, and con artists stage spooks to haul in profits. Next, the skeptics roll in. Researchers pin it on warped floors or crafty rodents, and the excitement dims, but the legends linger. Those eerie tales cling like dust, sparking late-night talks and chilling books. Mackay dubs it a romance with dread. We chase the scare, even if it's nonsense. It's a snug, spooky trip that reels you in with every jolt and murmur, leaving you chuckling at the lunacy and perhaps peeking twice at your own shadowy nooks. Popular Follies of Great Cities. Wander along a lively 18th-century street in London or Paris, and you'll tumble into a spectacle of oddities, These are the popular follies that transform city life into a zany performance. Visualize the bottle conjurer hoax of 1749. A man vows to cram himself into a small bottle, fills a theater, then bolts, leaving an enraged crowd to wreck the joint. Street vendors shout catchy tunes like Cherry Ripe, while a goofy slogan, What a Shocking Bad Hat, catches fire, prompting people to heckle strangers for fun. It's a whirlwind of disorder, fast, noisy, and nutty, where the throng's always eager to grab the next big giggle or absurdity. These trends don't merely fade, they explode. A charlatan's miracle cure drains purses, a daft ditty launches a dance frenzy, and occasionally the authorities intervene when the uproar turns too fierce. Mackay pegs it as the heartbeat of city lunacy, antsy spirits craving a jolt to brighten their routine. It's an endearing jumble, crude, absurd, and teeming with energy sweeping you into the fray, like you're sidestepping fruit stalls and humming along. You're laughing at the hijinks, caught up in the buzz, already wondering what outrageous caper might erupt in your own neighborhood tomorrow. Popular admiration of great thieves? Greet the rascals who didn't merely nab treasures. They snatched the limelight and our affection, too. Consider Dick Turpin, England's 1700s highwayman plundering coaches with a smirk, riding off like a dashing outlaw, and earning admirers who'd toast his name over pints. Over in France, Cartouche executes thefts so smooth Paris fawns, evading justice until the scaffold snags him in 1721. It's a scoundrel's tale, fearless, flashy, and oozing charisma, and the masses can't help cheering for these renegades who scoff at the stuffed shirts in power. You're caught up in the escape, quietly rooting as they dash, captivated by the raw audacity of it. The finale stings, however. Turpin dangles in 1739, Cartouche buckles under torment, and the cheers turn bitter. Yet the myth? That's ironclad barroom yarns and cheap pamphlets keep them thriving, brushing off the filth for a sprinkle of grandeur. Mackay probes the reason. We adore a rogue who teeters on the brink, defying the establishment. This saga's a heist with soul-swift, spirited, and faintly poignant gripping you with every bold haul. You're astride the horse, tasting the thrill, enthralled by how a crook could spin felony into a crowd-thrilling masterpiece. Duels and Ordeals. Venture into a foggy sunrise where two men square off, weapons drawn, over a sharp quip or a tipped drink that's duels and ordeals, where honor's a battle to the end. In medieval times, it's trial by combat. Smash your rival to show God's on your side, then leap ahead to the 1700s. And it's pistols at 10 steps for any aristocrat with a dented pride. France is duel-obsessed, England's close-behind assistants fret, onlookers stare, and blood flows over trifles. It's a fierce, wild rush glory's the reward, and every bout feels like a scene ripped from a poet's yarn. You're at the edge, heart-pounding, gripped by the fray. Ordeals are the otter kin imagine plunging hands into boiling water or treading glowing embers to let destiny point out the culprit. By the 1800s, dueling's height like Hamilton's fatal 1804 face-off wanes as laws clamp down and people begin chuckling rather than cocking guns. Mackay labels it honor run amok. Thousands perish for nothing, yet the spectacle's addictive. It's a gritty, blade-flashing epic tot, sorrowful, and downright nuts drawing you into every thrust and blast. You're present, feeling the dust, enthralled by a realm where a fiery temper and a keen edge could resolve or finish everything. Relics. Ever grasp something ancient and sense a jolt as if it's murmuring tales? That's the relic racket where a saint's knuckle or a cross fragment becomes a passport to paradise. Medieval Europe's mad for it. Churches hawk pieces of the true cross, enough to craft a fleet, petal flasks of sacred blood, and see pilgrims pour in, purses ready. The Crusades kick it into overdrive knights haul back holy loot, and by the 1200s every shrine's boasting a relic to parade. It's a divine grift half-belief, half-con where a weathered shred might heal your woes or snag heavenly favor. You're swept into the chase, captivated by the allure these keepsakes radiate. Next, the doubters barge in, Luther's gang counts up bogus crossbits, and the Reformation dulls the relic gleam. Yet the loyalists cling on, conflicts erupt, travelers trudge, like the throngs hunting Becket's blood after his 1170 slaying. Mackay views it as faith gone wild, will swallow any tale if it's holy enough. This one's an odd treasure, pious, raucous, and a touch cunning pulling you into a frenzy for fragments that rocked history. You're part of the journey, awed by the racket, enthralled by how a speck of grime could hold such sway. Closing thoughts. Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds goes beyond just recounting history. It's a sharp look into the workings of human psychology, showing how quickly folks can get caught up in shared misconceptions. Charles Mackay digs into some of the craziest manias from the past, pointing out that the forces behind them, greed, fear, and the need to fit in, are still kicking around today, same as they were ages ago. His book stands as a strong nudge to remember that a crowd's belief doesn't automatically make something true. These tales of bubbles, superstitions, and mass frenzy aren't just fun to read. They pack some real wisdom about thinking critically. Spotting the traps that tripped people up before can steer us toward better judgment now, with a bit more doubt and alertness. Whether it's financial markets, politics, or passing fads, Mackay's observations still hit home, pushing us to second-guess what we take as fact before tagging along with the masses.